show the official food, then sort out, but it's not fair that it starts without the agenda. Am I right? Shall we give it another 5 minutes? Have you seen all the hands, ma? Okay.
I warn you, you haven't come across the Standing Committee on Finance yet,
okay,
right?
Okay, okay.
There's nobody like this committee
in the history of any,
the ANC people. The other parties, they're not really relevant in our committee. But
please prepare me.
Secondly, I need to tell you, unlike other committees, Comrade Chair, we have a chief heckler. Fortunately, Comrade Chief Heckler, not fortunately, Comrade Chief Heckler is not well, she's on leave.
Okay.
But, so you'll have an easier ride today.
Okay. All right, as I start, shall I then inform the committee that the rules that are guiding Parliament will also apply? Thank you very much for the smooth running of this meeting. Thank you very much. All right, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, we are on item number one, which is opening and welcome. Somebody's just said chair. Okay. The way in which he can join us. Are you happy there? Why don't you swap chairs, at least so that it's here, so that if we want to consult with you, it should be easy for me. Okay, thank you very much. So let's start. We are on opening and welcome. Good morning once more. Good morning, honourable members. Good morning to the staff and all guests, including the media people. I do want, or I do wish to welcome you all to this very important meeting, wherein we will receive a briefing from the Parliamentary Budget Office on their 2016 pre-MTBPS analysis. The intention of the brief and the engagement is to prepare members for discussions on key issues in our macroeconomic environment informing the 2016 MTBPS and current progress made with the implementation of the 2016 budget. And the whole aim, of course, is to prepare honourable members for discussions around the 2016 medium-term budget policy statement. Honourable members, you know that South Africa faces exceptionally difficult global and domestic economic conditions. This may be so over the next several years. We also note that to expand the social wage in a sustainable manner, create jobs and reduce poverty, South Africa needs much faster rate of inclusive economic growth. We are a government that recognizes that it cannot address South Africa's economic and development challenges alone. And we will need all to work together. And working together, we can achieve more. Let us have a fruitful engagement on this very important briefing. But just an announcement that the Standing Committee on Appropriations will be with you until the end of the first presentation. And thereafter, we've got another business with PRASA, so we will then leave the meeting and you continue with the other business of this joint meeting. Thank you very much. Otherwise, you are all welcome. Let's feel free. Let's be open-minded, so that we can engage freely. What's important is that we achieve on the objective of this meeting.
Listen, just to remind people, based on our last two sittings of the committee, we agreed that since we couldn't unfortunately sit with you yesterday on the PBO presentation on the school university fees matter, what's going to happen is around 12:15, 12:30, as you suggested, we will end this thing. And then the PBO will brief the two finance committees, because Comrade Charles says his committee also hasn't. So the idea there is just to get a briefing, short briefing, and to pose some questions. But the matter resides, already affects both committees, primarily with appropriations. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And, of course, we will co-chair this meeting between ourselves. You can see these are the chairpersons. Honorable Member Mohai, am I right? Honorable Member Mohai, myself, and Honorable Member, and Honorable Member Yulo. All right. We will then move to the next item, which is apologies. From the Secretariat, can you share with us information on the apologies?
Morning, Honourable Members. From the Standing Committee on Appropriations, we have two apologies, one from Honourable Shope Sithole and one from Honourable Manana. They are both unwell.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir, if you can come in.
Thank you, Chairperson. From the Select Committee on Appropriations, we do not have any apologies. Thank you.
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part. If you can just raise your voice so that we can all hear.
Sorry, Chair. I was saying, Chair, from the Select Committee on Appropriations, we have not received any apology.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Finance?
I'm trying to look for... Oh, there's Alan. He will do it.
Yeah, no, I was about to raise on our behalf. I see he's taking over the role of the committee secretary. Yeah, okay, fine. We got apologies from Comrade Tandi Tobias Pokola, who's on leave. Makosi Kosa, for the life of me, I don't know why, he's still writing exams post-PhD. I hope people are learning from that, that you never stop studying.
Of course, learning is continuing.
And then Comrade Pule is back. Our committee noted and expressed our condolences. The letter is on its way to you about your grandfather. From our side, I think that's it. Oh, yes. Mr. Kwanko has also tendered his apology. He's from the UDM, so he's got lots of committees.
Chair, from the Select Committee for Finance, we received zero apologies. There are members not present without an apology.
Well, thank you very much for the information. Honourable Members, do we accept the apologies? Any seconder? Seconded. Shall we then proceed to item number 3, which is pre-MTBPS presentation by Parliamentary Budget Office. Let me consult with the other chairpersons. Do we need introductions?
No,
we don't. Chair, do we need introductions? All right, we'll skip introductions and go straight into the presentation. I will now call upon Professor Zahid to lead us in this presentation.
Thank you, Honourable Co-Chairs, Honourable Members, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. Honourable Chair, I think maybe just to add on to your opening statements, as you all are aware, the PBO provides independent, objective advice and analysis to the Finance and Appropriations Committees in both houses. So, and it relates to money bills and any other bills with financial implications. So that's my standard opening statement. Chair, as you correctly indicated, our presentation is there to provide members with information to make decisions. What we will provide you with today is the macroeconomic environment that informs the MTBPS 2016, current progress that is made with the implementation of the 2016 budget, so it gives you an idea as how far we've achieved and what we've done so far in terms of the budget. We've also looked at some information around provinces and metros, which we thought is important just to indicate to you the levels of progress made with their budgets and their processes. And as I've indicated, Chair, the main aim is to allow members to have a discussion around the medium-term budget policy statement and also to highlight the key findings of the analysis that we provide to you. We hope and we trust that, and we know that past experience with the Finance and Appropriation Committees in both houses, this has led us to a situation where we could make informed decisions pre the MTBPS. We will also make a subsequent analysis and assessment post-MTBPS, which we hope you'll present to this committee as well. Chair, I will now hand over to my colleague to begin with the first phase of the presentation. Thank you very much, members, Chair.
Thank you, with permission from the Honourable Chair. I'll start, and what we'll do in the beginning is because we live in such precarious times globally, we'll talk about the global and South African context, and to say that we continue to live in the aftermath of the largest financial and economic crash since the 1928-33 Great Depression. So thinking about what happened before the crisis allows us to realize the limitations of within the global economy and our own economy, and also to think about the expected levels of growth and the economic growth path that we currently on. And within this context, I think it's important that we acknowledge that economic development and the growth path is path dependent. The growth, what we did in the past affects what we can do today and also the shapes the path into the future. So if we think about path dependency, it affects not only in terms of our investment and where we invested within the economy and which sectors, but also in terms of who we gave credit to. The fact that a large part of the population don't have proper access to credit markets does still continue to shape what we can do and where we're going, who gets access to education, the cost of education affects where we're going, and it currently affects what happened in the past with regard to how those things were invested in and funded affects where we are today as well. The period before the global financial crisis was a period of increasing levels of debt. If we think about this in terms of leverage, in terms of the amount of debt relative to assets in the economy, and it was a period from the 90s onwards of a period of huge increase in global liquidity that fed into debt markets that allowed bubbles to form in real estate, financial asset markets, etc. Now, this increased debt led and contributed to a lot of the GDP growth we saw in the period right before the crisis. Through increasing aggregate demand, economic activity and fixed investment, trade and concentration along global value chains, speculative cross-border international capital flows, and also growing volatility in currency markets and in our exchange rates. The impact of increased debt varied across different countries based on how they used their debt and also the conditions and the shape of those economies. So if we look at what happened in China and many Asian countries before the crisis, it led to increased investment and exports, just as an example of one of what happened. Within the USA, Latin America, and South Africa, we had increased debt-driven consumption and speculation in financial and real estate markets. The global financial crisis contributed to a process of debt deleveraging and low GDP. And we see that stimulus activities had limited impacts, and in areas like quantitative easing, it didn't stimulate often real investment, but continued speculation and bubbles forming in some asset markets globally. So we have a situation in the global economy where uncertainty continues to discourage investment in the real sectors of the economy. It's a period also of macroeconomic experimentation, and where there have been mainstream economists within academia and the US Federal Reserve and other government and related institutions sort of realizing the limitations of the approaches that they've chosen and their theories, and trying unconventional policies, and here specifically a questioning of conventional approaches to fiscal policy. Now, without giving too much background, fiscal policy was, after the post-Second World War, the lead policy in terms of driving the macroeconomic goals, which after the Second World War period in most countries was full employment. With the monetarist revolution in the 80s, the goals shifted towards price stability and inflation, and monetary policy led. And since that time, it's been the orthodox approach to say that you drive changes through monetary policy rather than through fiscal policy. And what we've seen in the last few years, as countries have found the limitations of zero interest rate policies, and in the EU and Japan moving towards negative interest rate policies, that there's been attempts, and often discrete attempts, of trying to use fiscal policy and to align those. Within this context, we're seeing that the main problems being addressed by the developed countries within the global economy are not related to CPI, consumer price inflation, but to asset price inflation. They're not related to growing inflation, but concerns about deflation. We in developing countries are differently affected, but I think in terms of developing our fiscal policy frameworks, we need to take into account those changes in thinking and approaches in developed countries, and think about formulating our own policies in response to those. Because often we in developing countries are on the receiving end of things like quantitative easing, where huge amounts of liquidity are put into the market by central banks, and they don't go into fixed investment in the developed countries where they were aimed at stimulating the economies. They come into our financial and real estate markets and drive up those prices and create bubbles. And they also create a false sense of what the economy is doing and increasing volatility within our macroeconomy. The last point I want to make on the slide about the global context is that the period that I'm talking about, particularly this year, has been one of sovereign credit downgrades, a huge amount. A Financial Times article in July noted that up to that point, Fitch had downgraded 14 countries, Standard & Poor's 16 countries, and Moody's 23 countries. About 1 or 2 weeks later, when Britain was suffering the impact of the Brexit vote, the Financial Times had an article questioning whether credit ratings actually still count, looking at the impact in terms of stocks and other things within Britain, but also referring back to the US after they were downgraded after the global financial crisis. Again, we in developing countries, I think, are in a more difficult position than the developed countries, and we have to take that seriously. We have an appendix in the full report that refers to a study that was done by the World Bank with contributions from the South African Reserve Bank, looking at the impact of a downgrade on the South African economy to where we fall below investment grading. And just to say quickly what the findings of that was, without going into too much detail, is one, they basically are very uncertain because of the availability of data and the length of the data, but they do find that it does increase, the experience is that it does increase the interest rates that government ends up having to pay for their debt, possibly up to 1.5 or 1.6%. But there's also a lot of speculation about how much the market has already factored into that. And so we're unsure about that impact, but also they find very little impact, and they say this may be because of the limitations of the data on the currency and other things. And so I think there's a lot of work and thinking that we need to do in the face of continued threats of downgrades, and how we respond to it, and take into account that this has become a global phenomenon, including developed countries. Within the South African context, the period of relatively high growth in the South African economy before the crisis was an unsustainable one, It is one where the increases in global financial liquidity led to increasing capital flows, especially short-term capital flows, into the South African economy. This then filtered down into South African credit markets, and credit extension to the private sector increased by 23% of GDP from 2000 to 2008. But during that period, we saw that private business investment increased by only 4% of GDP. The two things happening there is you don't finance long-term fixed investment with short-term inflows in terms of maturity risks, but also when you see liquidity driving big increases in stock prices and property prices, you go for the short-term investments rather than the long-term fixed investments as two of the possible reasons amongst many. Most credit to the private sector then ended up going towards debt-driven consumption, increased speculation in financial and real estate markets, and as we've seen from parts of government, the Davis Commission, the Mbeki, former President Mbeki leading the UNECA's questioning of base erosion activities and illicit financial movements, it seems that quite a bit of that, and I think we need to work on quantifying that more, has gone towards base erosion activities. The economic growth path, investment and employment was driven by these activities over a period of starting in the 90s, but through that period up to the global financial crisis. And by the time we had the crisis and the process of deleveraging globally, we saw an end to GDP growth driven by debt-driven consumption and increased speculation in finance and real estate markets. And we saw the end of large housing construction projects. We saw an end of the spending sprees on automobiles and other things. So the prospects for household consumption and private investment today is low. Therefore, government consumption and public investment may be what is required for GDP growth. But as I'll come to, we see that they're very real challenges in that regard. So looking at the macroeconomic outlook in our current period, say that South Africa's outlook worsened since the tabling of the budget review in February 2016. It's estimated that South Africa will experience its lowest annual GDP growth in 5 years due to the low growth to date in 2016, a poor outlook for investment and private consumption, as I mentioned, fiscal consolidation and a slowdown in public spending, and a subdued global growth outlook. Just to mention on that, there are several risks that I didn't mention when talking about the global situation, including the most recent numbers on growth in China, which came in at 6.3%, which seems huge, but for China that causes real concerns for the global economy, that level of growth and lower than estimated growth. Also the level of bubbles and problems in the financial and real estate markets also cause for concern for the global economy. So the 2016 budget review forecasted real GDP growth of 0.9% for 2016, and I'll come to a graph showing the estimates and the forecast. The updated forecasts indicate that growth for the current year will be between 0.1% and 0.4%. So what we've done, and we've included in the report and the slides, is just a table of the different institutions, the Treasury, the Reserve Bank, the BER, the IMF, the World Bank, and Reuters, that give expectations of the growth outlook, and we see that over all of them, they've been down. They've revised the growth forecast downwards for both this year and next year. The growth forecast uncertainty. This is what's commonly called a fan chart. And the outer lines from 2015, okay, let me, these and these are basically when you've got the highest level of confidence that your growth forecast is going to fall within that area. But as you can see, that's a hugely wide area, and so it's not really practical to draw on that. What we see with the black lines is sort of where the 50% confidence interval is, and we see that the estimates from the Reserve Bank, where the diamonds are, falling within that 50% confidence interval, and the dotted line is sort of the what was estimated at the 2016 review by National Treasury. And so we're seeing how much we're coming below that in 2016 and beyond in terms of the revisions downwards. Thank you. The next chart shows the situation in terms of revenue and expenditure. Maybe I should take that back. With the red line showing revenue from 2006 up to 2015-16, 2016-17, and then projections beyond that. Sorry, I've got the frog in my throat again today. And we see that from 2007-08, this increasing divergence between expenditure and revenue, leading to the green line, which is the balanced budget as a percentage of GDP. After the crisis, it crashes, recovers a bit, but remaining at the high period, and then this period when it does recover is referred to as a period of counter-cyclical policy, where National Treasury says that they did increase spending in terms of to stimulate the economy after the crisis, but we see that as things don't recover in the global economy and problems remain in the domestic economy, that and as debt to GDP increases, there's a move towards consolidation that I'm sure all the honourable members know quite well. And so we see a decrease in the last 2 years of the budget balance as a percentage of GDP, and if we continue with the fiscal framework, a further reduction to about 2% of GDP, a negative 2% of GDP. So the budget, persisting budget deficits in a context of slow growth has raised concerns about the sustainability of the country's fiscal framework. In response to these concerns, government is pursuing fiscal consolidation. The objective is to return the country to a sustainable fiscal trajectory by stabilizing debt as a share of GDP. This includes both revenue and expenditure measures, new revenue-raising measures, introduction of an expenditure ceiling, and introduction of efficiency measures. This challenge is compounded by the need to maintain and increase social spending in line with a growing population confronted with fewer employment opportunities. The next graph shows growth in debt, and the green columns show the actual increase in debt in nominal terms, and the line shows it as a percentage of GDP, and we see this growth from 22% to predicted 46% by 2018-19. And one of the things worth pointing out is that as our possibilities for GDP growth decline, we can expect that debt and debt repayments as a percentage of GDP will grow. And so even if we aren't spending that much more money as government. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sir Raj. Morning, honourable members and guests. I will take you through the revenue section, expenditure, and we will also talk about some of the policy priorities for the next medium-term expenditure framework. In terms of revenue, because of the lower anticipated economic growth, revenue also decreased because there's a close relationship between revenue collection and economic growth. So in response to governments, government started to introduce and raise additional revenue. So last year or this year, they anticipated to raise an additional 18.1 billion, or an increase of 9.8% from the previous financial year. So, but the tax data for the first 5 months of this financial year actually is indicating that growth is a bit slow. It's about 6.2%. So in terms of that, if growth continues over the remainder of the financial year at 6.2%, the budget office is basically estimating that we're going to under-collect by 39 billion in 2016-17. The 2016 MTIF revenue raising proposals also proposed revenue collection increases and changes to tax to raise another 15 billion. Just to show you the growth rates in the five largest revenue sources, we anticipated that personal income tax will grow by 12.5%. At this stage, in the first 5 months, the growth was only 9.8%. VAT increased by 3%. It was anticipated to grow by 8.3%. Corporate income tax, we've got a bit of an increase there. It's 5.3% against a target of 4.9%. The fuel levy also is collected more than what was anticipated. It's currently, we see a growth of 8.2%. And then in total, I've mentioned that we said we're going to, revenue is going to increase by 9.8%, but currently it's only by 6.2% at this stage. This is just a graph to show you the different sectors and what the influence of the changes in the revenue collection and the tax policies were. I'm just going to show you, indicate to you the three biggest ones. In terms of the financial markets, you can see it's still the corporate income tax is still growing slower than in the previous period in the 2015-16 financial year. Manufacturing is also one of the biggest sources of revenue. Corporate income tax is still growing slower as well as VAT. And then the same picture with corporate income tax. So corporations are actually doing worse than what was anticipated. So it's still growing slower. It's just the VAT is a bit growing higher than in the previous financial year. Then in terms of expenditure of national departments, I'm only showing you a selected few national departments. In our full report, we will show all 40 national departments. So when you look at Home Affairs, at this stage, in the first 5 months, Home Affairs already spent 53.7% of their total budget. Another, higher education, which is currently under discussion, already spent 61.8% of the appropriation. When we look at water and sanitation, they're on 34, so it's quite slow. Slow spending for the first 5 months. Also to mention that the guiding principle, the notional benchmark for spending for this time of the financial year is about 42%. So we compare these expenditure rates with 42%. Sport and recreation is currently only on 27% for the first 5 months. In terms of the economic classification, when we look at higher education, the biggest expenditure was in terms of the transfer. So higher education had transferred 66% of the appropriation already. Energy, low spending on current payments, and you must also just remember that current payments include COE and goods and services. Telecommunications are only on 20% with current expenditure, and sport and recreation is on 21% with their transfers. So sport and recreation hasn't really transferred the grant money. This is what the indication is. In terms of provincial revenue and expenditure, provincial data that we have is only for the first quarter. So the national benchmark is 25% that we compare this with. In terms of revenue, provinces has collected 22.6% and expenditures on 22.1%. When we compare the different provinces with each other, you will see that, and specifically on social services, when we look at the education sector, the Eastern Cape is the lowest of the nine provinces. The Free State is the highest on education, but Free State is the lowest on health. When we look at the social development sector, Mpumalanga is the lowest one, and the Western Cape is quite high on social development expenditure. But total expenditure, you can see most of them are around or almost at 25%. In comparing the provinces in terms of the economic classification expenditure, in terms of current expenditure, you will see that they almost all on 25%, close to 25%, except the Northern Cape, Northwest, and the Western Cape is slow. They much lower than the national benchmark of 25. But you can see in terms of transfers, Free State has transferred a lot of money. So, and capital payments, you can see it's still low. It's lower than 20% in most of the provinces. But when you compare current payments with transfer payments, you will see that transfer payments always make up for slow current expenditure. So it's easy to transfer money to make sure that your total expenditure is still within that national benchmark. So if you're slow on current, you just transfer, so they will equal each other out. Then we also looked at the financial position of metropolitan municipalities. But just to note that this is preliminary results. It's the data that I've used was from the end of the fourth quarter, Section 71 reports, but I've also used the preliminary annual financial statements. When we do calculations to determine asset management, it is expected of municipalities to spend at least between 10 and 20% on capital expenditure. Below this, we can expect that there will be slow service delivery in a municipality that spends lower than 10%. At this stage, all the metros spend more than 10% of their expenditure on capital. In terms of debt management, approximately 75% of total debt was outstanding for more than 90 days at this stage in total for metros. In terms of liquidity management, you will see a current ratio shows the ability of a municipality to pay back its short-term liabilities with its short-term assets. A range of between 1.5 and 2.1 is expected as normal. So the higher current ratio, the more capable the municipality is to pay its current or short-term obligations. Preliminary results show that Johannesburg and Tshwane have ratios below 1, which suggests that these municipalities would be unable to pay its current or short-term obligations if they fall due at any specific point. In terms of expenditure management, it's expensive. So it's expected that all metros must maintain a normal ratio of 25% to 40% in terms of spending on compensation of employees. At this stage, most there isn't any metro that spend more than 40% on compensation. If the ratio exceeds the norm, it will show that there's inefficiencies, overstaffing, and the incorrect focus is due to misdirection of expenditure to non-essential or non-service delivery related expenditure. Ekurhuleni, eThekwini, and the city of Tshwane, the preliminary numbers show that they've overspent on their compensation expenditure. Then I also compared the expenditure on compensation in terms of their personnel numbers. At this stage, the city of Tshwane overspent by 4.5%, while they still reflect a vacancy of more than 9,000 vacancies. The city of Johannesburg has spent 96.5% of their adjusted budget, and that actually provides very little space to fill more than 6,000 vacancies in that metro. When we try and look at the efficiencies of municipalities, municipalities should at least recover their operational costs. The net operational surplus margin assesses the extent to which the municipality generates operating surpluses. So the norm is zero. They shouldn't accumulate surpluses. And if a municipality has a surplus, it is expected that they spend it on capital. So they must reinvest the surplus funding. All metros showed positive surplus margins, except for Mangaung. But it is also important to note that if the ratio is positive, then it must be monitored if this is a continuous trend. Because if this is a continuous trend, it means that metros are building up surplus funds. So then I also looked at grant dependency. It also relates to the surplus funding, because some municipalities show that they are dependent on grants to spend on capital. But if you have surplus funds, you actually shouldn't be so dependent on national government to transfer grants for capital expenditure. So what this is also showing that Cape Town, Johannesburg and Mangaung is currently funding more than 50% of their capital expenditure. And Metro spend about 34.9 billion on capital, and this is 85.9% of their adjusted budgets. They've spent 85%. Johannesburg and Tshwane is the highest spenders. They've spent 91% and 92%. Slow spending was in Buffalo City at 73%. In total, Metro spent 80.5% of their conditional grant funding. So they didn't even spend all their grant transfers at the end of the financial year. Just to look at funding priorities, we know we're all talking about education, the pressures in health with the NHI, the pressures in delivering services. But we do have the National Development Plan with the 14 medium-term strategic frameworks. And most of the issues that we're currently feeling and that we are discussing and debating are basically taken up in the medium-term strategic framework. A long and healthy life for all. NHI is included in that, and NHI is currently also putting a lot of pressure on the current fiscus. A skilled and capable workforce, that is our higher education pressures, and efficient, competitive and responsive economic infrastructure network, that includes our broadband, our energy and our transport. The responsive, accountability, effective and efficient local government system, all the services that we need to provide are also, and which are currently under pressure, are within that medium-term strategic framework and taken up in that outcome. So in terms of the monitoring of the implementation of the medium-term strategic framework, the PBO has done quite a bit of work on the National Development Plan and how to monitor the medium-term strategic framework. So when we did the analysis of the 2014-15 outcomes, we saw that there was very slow growth. We really wanted to provide, at this stage, we wanted to provide the outcome for the 2015-16 year, but the data is still not available 7 months after the end of the financial year. Other constraints that we found within the NDP and MTSF is the alignment between the budget function groups with the 14 outcomes. There's also not alignment of the management structures of the medium-term strategic framework and the management structures of the budget. And then we also compared the conditional grants, and we found that the conditional allocations and outputs are not, the outputs of the conditional grants are not in line with the medium-term strategic framework processes. The quality of the reporting on the medium-term strategic framework is, at this stage, not very user-friendly, very difficult to monitor the outputs of the and the performance on the MTSF. The integration of the medium-term strategic framework into standard budget and planning processes, there's also very, you can't really see the real integration, because if there was good integration, it wouldn't be that difficult to monitor the progress on the MTSF. So thank you. Professor Jahid will just summarize the presentation for us.
Thank you, Nelia. Thank you. Thank you, honourable members. Honourable chairs, honourable members, I think in terms of our summary and what you've glanced from our presentation, we note, I think, from the overall macroeconomic conditions that clearly government's counter-cyclical fiscal policy has supported growth since the slowdown of the global and the local economy and following the crisis in 2008. We also see that the South African economy is in a period of low growth. And we've indicated to you on our table that the South African Reserve Bank, for example, expects growth only to grow by 0.4% this year. Low growth is and has affected revenue collections. There's no doubt about this, and this is clearly an impact that we're going to have to face and look at in the economy. The PBO, as we've indicated, estimates a shortfall of 39 billion for 2016-17. We also note that unemployment has been persistently high, honourable members, chair. Particularly concerning is the definition of broad youth employment of around 49%, unemployment of 49%, which I think is a crisis that we need to address. Investment levels are low, and it's one of the areas we need to focus on in terms of strengthening growth. We note that debt has increased significantly, and how we manage debt is going to be a critical issue. What we've seen as a result of this debt is that there's been a growing interest payments. There's reduced funds available for expenditure priorities. Debt to GDP for 2016-17 is likely to be higher than the estimated budget revenue. We also note that the country's foreign currency credit rating could be downgraded to a non-investment grade status probably in December. And of course this necessitates that the medium-term budget policy statement needs to demonstrate the continuations of government's commitment to responsible management of public finance and our public resource allocation. Government has previously introduced several fiscal consolidation measures, as you will remember, and as we've indicated, these indicate expenditure ceilings. There's been revenue changes, efficiency measures, and of course a review of transfers to institutions with surplus funds. A reduction in government expenditure growth is expected, while necessary for fiscal consolidation. I think lower government expenditure is going to slow down growth going forward. And we need to think and consider this very carefully. Funding priorities, I think it's about resource allocation. And most of you have noticed and indicated that the education crisis, energy, unemployment, infrastructure development, these are going to be critical funding priorities which you're going to have to look at in a broader context than just the tunnel vision approach of focusing on one priority. Honourable Chairs, Honourable Members, thank you for the opportunity that you provided to the PBO, and we are willing to address any questions going forward. Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you so much for the elaborate and insightful presentation. I will now hand over to my colleague, Honourable Dipier, to take over.
Okay, thank you very much. Honourable Members, there you have it. The PBO created the appetite for us to engage with the MTBBS. Next week, I want to also take you to page 25. The slide, monitoring of the implementation of the MTSF. You also indicated, Professor Chahet and your team, the areas we have to focus on in our oversight exercise on the, not only the MTBBS, but the national budget as well. Looking at the provinces, and that's what we do as Select Committee on Finance and Appropriation, but also the city's economy. Very important, the provincial growth and development strategies. How is that progressing? Because it's, we're not an island. We are a united country. We've got lots of work to do. Honourable Members, let's be efficient and effective with our questions, short and to the point. Let's go down this side, number one, number two, number three in the first row. One, two, three. Mossel Bay. Four, five, six, seven. I always told the two students, put up your hand high if you want to be seen. You're the last on that side, right?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the presentation. I want to deal with the PBO's estimated revenue shortfall, which on slide 12, as you said, Professor, you estimate would be 39 billion rand in this financial year. I wonder if you, I mean, is that figure credible given two factors? The first is it seems that your calculation is linear and you haven't assumed that there might be an increasing rate of collections in the second half of the financial year. And second of all, that you have used, as you said, 5 months of data when 6 months of data is in fact available. I do not regard that figure as credible. I think you need to defend that figure. Chairperson, which brings me to the nub of the issue. I mean, what we really need in this exercise is some idea of what the total adjustment is likely to be, given the fact that growth has declined, as you correctly point out, to a range of possibly between 0.1% and 0.4%. We need a forecast of the effect of that phenomena on revenue, expenditure, the deficit, and debt. But the fact is, after 3 years and throwing millions of rands at the PBO, that's exactly what we don't have. And my question is, why? I mean, frankly, the PBO has to raise its game. This presentation is literally a first-year economics class with rookie errors. That is my view.
The PBO can put to us scenarios, but the PBO can't come up with a final answer. Honourable Lees.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you to the PBO. I'm not sure that I'm possibly not building on what David had said, but given the high debt levels, the low growth that persists, is it your opinion that the expenditure ceiling is now still sufficient, or should we be looking at actually cutting costs or reducing expenditure in line with the forecasts on revenue and so on? It's similar, but I'm just looking at whether indeed there is there's now an urgent need to look at more robust look at expenditure.
We recognize our visitors in the gallery. You're very welcome. Good morning. Number three.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It is elucidating on a number of things. Obviously, for the purposes of this meeting, it's difficult to cover everything. But if I were to come to my question, Doctor, you speak of macroeconomic experimentation and unconventional macroeconomic policies. You touched on QE, that is quantitative easing. Perhaps one would like to know what has been the impact of those unconventional policies in those countries that you were looking at. And then perhaps coming closer home, have we adopted any of the unconventional so-called macroeconomic policies, or we've just stuck with doing things the old way? That's one. Looking at number two, looking at your ratios, for instance, your debt-GDP ratios, they are indeed very useful. But I think it will also be useful to, when you present that, you also include other countries, for instance, I would say countries in BRICS and countries at our level, so that you can see how we are doing. If my research is correct, for instance, while we're around 46%, Brazil will be around about 58.9%, India 66.4%, Nigeria 11.5%. So you can see that they are all over. But I think that becomes very important to have that benchmarking so that we can see how we're doing and the implications thereof. I think an important projection that we should be having, it's a projection on inflation. For obvious reasons, especially for the fiscals, as it impacts on their interest rates, and therefore the price of money that government is paying. So I think we need to have that projection. It's very important. You know, it also affects a number of other variables in the bigger economy. But I think. And another very important thing, Prof. and your team, we need to not lose sight of the impact of this, what's going to be happening, for instance, on poverty levels and inequality, especially the party that I come from. That becomes very important, that all these things is well and good to look at these macroeconomic variables. But I think people out there, they would be interested in knowing what is going to be the impact of of this. Lastly, I don't know. I think we have sort of failed with all the expenditure to try and crowd in private sector investments. Right? The last statistics I saw was that about 700 billion rand was lying idle, not being invested in the real economy. And one would like to argue that until such time that we are able to crowd in private sector investments, some of the challenges will be permanent, will never be able to solve. So I'm just saying, one, perhaps as we do all these things, we should also be alive to the fact that we can't be able to solve the South African problems, economic problems. We also need to try and crowd in private sector investment. Thanks, Chair.
That can be one of the questions to the Minister at the briefing next week about the engagement with private sector regarding this 600 billion rand. It was mentioned in Business Day on Friday. There was a report on that. Our good lady there on that side, then we go down the row. Father? I can see a prophet. Order, please. You on the floor, lady.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. It's for us as the Appropriations Committee, is just a very unusual meeting because people just talk the way they want and in and how in. We are not used. Our meetings are very orderly, so it's quite new for us to see that meetings are being conducted in this manner in the Finance Committee. Mine is on...
This is the finance family consisting of four committees on the member. Please proceed with your
mine
question.
Is on,
thank you.
On
I plead guilty unconditionally. The chairperson's responsible and I'm happy to be responsible. Criticize me. Thank you.
All right.
Feel free.
On page 19, yeah, you can respond to me later outside. Don't degenerate the meeting. Let us not degenerate the meeting. You must follow an example, Chair, but you, it seems you are...
Honourable Member, please engage with the question.
Page 19. My question is on page 19. I remember the last time when you presented to us. So you said quite your mandate, you unfortunately can't do recommendations and so forth to when you are doing your presentation and on your research work that you are doing. So I won't ask you for any recommendations today, but I just want to find out on page 19, is there any research work that you have done that can allocate what was the contributing factors to this low expenditures, especially in the Eastern Cape? Can it be maybe perhaps due to skills, due to fraud or corruption, any of that factors that that have contributed to thereof? Then on page or slide 23 as well, in the slow spending in Buffalo City as well, is there any factors that you can allude to us that we can take forward as to say why have you slow spent there? Because some of these, Buffalo City is a constituency of mine, so I would like to take it up further. And in which programs was this slow spent picked up? I think that is the only two for me, Chair, thanks.
The National Treasury produces the reports on the all municipalities, and it's available on their website as well. And the person responsible there at the Treasury is Mr. Jan Hartam. So all that information is additional to what we've just received on the Mr. Blanche.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just, I'm on page 26. You know, the professor alluded to the low investment. And I was just wondering whether there is an indication, you know, obviously we have low investment and we're also suffering from capital flight and what else. And my question is to what extent, or what percentage is it maybe known, to what extent, you know, the self-inflicting part on the country, you know, I'm thinking about issues like Nene Gate and the Pravin Gordhan Zuma saga at the moment, to what extent has that impacted on the investor confidence? And we have heard about 700 billion that is sitting, you know, in the economy and that's not invested. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chairperson. Just a few questions I'd like to raise. Firstly, the how long are we going to continue to dwell in the past? We keep on, we've got a problem to solve in our country, or a number. But we keep on dwelling on the past and blaming the history for the situation that we find ourselves in. We keep on talking about the global crisis of 2008. When are we going to start looking at solutions and how we can use that to improve or to solve the problems in the country? The second point is this economic growth that we are going through, and it's been predicted now that it's 0.1%, between 0.1% and 0.4%. A few weeks ago, we got excited with an economic growth of 3.3%, and everybody said, well, things are going well. So why is it that the country cannot continue with that trajectory, that upward trajectory? Because now it was 3.3%, and it seems though it's going to go back into negative, obviously, because if we're going to end up with a growth, an economic growth of 0.1%. And then the last point, Honourable Chairperson, is this debt that is spiraling out of control. A few years ago, we were quite content with 42% debt to GDP. The next year, we were content with 46%. Last year, we were content with 50%. And it seems as though next year, it's going to exceed 50%. So can we
try and set a target, although it is out of control, our control, but surely we need to set some sort of a benchmark. And what is that benchmark that we really, that this country can sustain? Thank you.
So you actually want to know how far are we from the fiscal cliff? In one sentence. Anyone in that room? Yes.
Thank you, Chair, and allow me to thank PBO for their presentation. But let me say that we are aware the deficit is increasing, the debt is increasing, the interest to debt is increasing, the high unemployment rate is increasing. We know these things. Now, we continue to import. You now heard that the poultry industry is talking about laying off thousands of workers because of the import. Manufacturing industry, textile industry is grounded, leather industry is grounded because of the imports from China. So we're not creating the jobs, we are rather importing. So I don't know if people can tell us what you do. We do talk repeatedly about wanting to change things and create more jobs and limit the imports. But it's not happening. That's the first thing. In terms of the high deficit and the debt that we owe, if we heard what the new procurement officer, CEO Kenneth Brown said, and I repeatedly said this previously, that we lose about 200 billion rand a year in this country as a result of not getting value for money, fraud, corruption, maladministration. He estimates 40% of approximately 600 billion, which is 240 billion, to not getting value for money. That already shows you can save 240 billion. Plus, if you take fraud, corruption, and maladministration, you can save 300 billion rand a year in this country. So maybe if PBO can tell us, what do we do? Because at the end of the day, there is indication maybe we start putting much more concentration on that aspect so we can actually save, because that's the amount of money that we are actually losing it in. Now, in light of what you're telling us, the scenario doesn't seem to be getting any better, because we've just heard water and sanitation, over 1.3 billion rand in irregular expenditure. Energy, same thing. About, what, 400 million, I think, is in unauthorized expenditure with water and sanitation. So the scenario never seems to be changing. It's just getting progressively worse all the time. And maybe you should tell us what is different we should do. There is no consequences. We fail to take action when people fail. Maybe what we see now in terms of education, maybe people need to rise and go and say, if this department continuously fails, let's remove the management and put somebody who can perform, who can save us these monies, because that is where we seem to be having quite a serious problem. It is repeatedly said that the state is the cash cow. As long as you're dealing with state, you make, you treble your monies, you charge them five times and six times as much. So that seems to be a problem. Maybe you need to start giving us, and I know it's unfair to push this onto PBO, you understand, but maybe you should tell us what we should be doing differently, because everything that we see now is bleak. And unless we change it, I think our poorest of the poor are continue to gonna become poorer, and the rich are going to continue to become richer. Thank you. I'll stop there, Chair.
Anyone in that I missed, maybe missed? Then we go to the back. Yes, yes, Honourable Member. Yes, you're on the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page 25, the high debt costs are recognised on the summary. I would be interested, because we are looking at a realistic potential of a downgrade, and that will affect our debt costs going forward. Can we get some form of an assessment of if we were to be downgraded, or for that matter upgraded, what the impact on the fiscus would be for this remaining period this year and potentially for next year's budget?
Food inflation is about 11.2%. Coffee increased by 21%. I like my coffee. 21% when I bought it this weekend doing shopping for my wife. Yes, it's quite in the shock when you come to the till. Oliver Essak.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. Lots has been said and a lot has been raised, and a few of my points were covered, but I'll attempt to be brief. Chairperson, just let's go back to the summary of Professor, who I think tried his level best to give us a synopsis. But just if we look at slide 25, it talks of counter-cyclical principles which were applied in fiscal policy. Now, surely, I mean, there have been many warnings for how long must this continue then to fall on deaf ears? You know, you continue leading the horse to the water, but you can't make him drink. I respect and understand that. But somewhere along the line, as my colleague alluded, or as Narend alluded earlier, I was saying that, Honorable Singh, that what, when, and how? Because if you go down to just on the same page, my colleague Honorable Topham alluded, he talked of higher debt costs. And obviously, as you mentioned, this results in less funds being available for distribution. Then how, I'm looking for guidance here, but then how would less funds available for distribution, how do we get on with the job of all these recommendations in this entire presentation? And then finally, you made a comment on the expenditure ceiling, which was also referred to in slide 10. It's on your slide 25. Again, we must look for guidance. Maybe as Honorable Singh said, you are not the authority. But then how, the question must arise in these committees, how much are we committed to this principle? What is the will? Or are we going to take the bull by the horns sometime or the other? And in conclusion, Chairperson, on the funding priorities, you quoted or you made a statement that were above resource allocation. Then I must ask, where to from here? Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes, the Honourable Member remarked that the bull by the horns is going to happen in Bloemfontein on Saturday afternoon, 3 o'clock, when the cheetahs do that. Yeah. See how Honourable Mohai is now smiling. All the Free Staters are smiling, yeah. Thank you, Honourable Members, on that light note.
Sorry, Chair, your indulgence for a second. I just wanted to correct the member. I'm Honourable Sheikh Imam, not Honourable Singh. Thank you.
Okay. Everyone is happy with that explanation. Honourable Members, I'm going to request the PBO team to reply. Go Chair, sorry.
Yeah. Firstly, I just want to, for us to think about this, but I think some of the questions we're putting to the PBO are a bit unfair. Yeah. They don't have the authority to make MRI recommendations. But on the other hand, it's something we need to talk about, the chairs here, that between just giving us a technical input and saying nothing, you might want to give us options and say, flowing from your observations, these are three or four options. So you're not prescribing to us, but you assisting us in finding answers, because you're the technical experts, not us. The second thing to say for myself, I can't speak for others. I've been in this parliament, if you don't know, since 94. And I must say, I know. Believe me, I know.
That's his expertise talking now, order.
And as I sit here, I know it even more. So let me say, I think it's not easy. Here's my big mouth again. As a politician, I can throw words, right, and not take responsibilities for it. But it would be nicer, I think, for me, I can't speak for others, if you explain simpler. Like, your input is too technical, really, for somebody like me, right? I don't have the experience of a Makosi Kosa or something, of the financial markets and the banks and so on, right? No, I can't speak for him. He can say whatever he wants, right? I mean, if you're not used to him, you'll get used. So on the one hand, I want to say that I think you must explain concepts, a bit more, so that we have a better feel. Because you meant to empower us, that's one of your aims. But at the same time, I also think, I'm not necessarily agreeing with David Mania, but I also think you need to be a bit more, given the constraints we've got, given the challenges we have, you need to increase, it's both possible to be simpler in explaining the technical concepts and also more helpful in putting options to us and taking the debate forward so that we see a significant leap between the input you've made this year
and the one you made last year, and even the one you made before the budget. I'm not necessarily agreeing with David's tone or what he is saying. He's got his own agenda for doing that, and I don't want to be treated with him, but I'm saying for myself, independently of him, right, I feel the same thing about, not in the way he does, and without the contempt necessarily that may or may not be implied in what he says, I think you do very good work. And I think you're very helpful to the institution. And I want to thank you. I know you're understaffed, under-resourced, and I really think you do well. But we need more, is what we are saying. And if you can't do it, the four chairs here on the advisory board with Cedric Frolic, we've got to deliver more. Never mind Parliament's financial constraints, you are very crucial. So the other thing to say, like for example, even your slide presentation, you know, I'm not great, really. You know, I can't understand why you would use different shades of green. Why can't you make it different colors? I mean, you're a former academic, I don't know the background. Tumusani's come from the university environment. We know him the best, right? But what I'm trying to say is you people have lectured and so on, right? I think Dumasani does that too at times. So why don't you make it in different colors? And it's more user-friendly, right? On the issue of macroeconomic experimentation, I don't think there's time. But at some stage, you need to tell us what exactly are you talking about there. I get a glimpse of what you're saying, but I don't fully understand it. Then you talk of unconventional macroeconomic policies. I'm not sure whether it's linked to your point that after Second World War, the driver of growth was fiscal policy, then it switched to monetary policy and so on. And what the precise relevance of that is to the current situation we confront in our country, it's not clear to me. I think, Comrade Chair, Kuchez, one of the issues you raise that I would like members to also, as a chair now, playing a co-chair role, think about is, I think you are right about this, I don't know what we do. You see, prospects for household consumption and private investment is low. Therefore, government consumption and public investment is required for GDP growth. I think that's a useful observation. But then the rest of your input also suggests how restricted the fiscal space is, right, and the monetary space. So it's a big challenge. On the one hand, you're making what I think is a useful observation, but on the other. Then the thing that struck me, and this is where I really think, this is the only question you need to answer. My other observations, which I think are a bit unfair to you, but if you want to respond, that's your right. But I think more, the only thing I really want you to respond to right now is your slide 24. You know, this is very important to many of us. This is the medium-term strategic framework. These are the 14 outcomes. What exactly do you mean? Now, this one I plead with you to give at least a quick answer. You say the alignment of the budget function groups with the 14 outcomes. I think you're saying they're not synergists. Right? What do you mean by that? Secondly, the alignment of the budget structures of the MTSF and the budget. What does that actually mean? Then a bit more on the other three things, because I think this is an issue the finance committee, finance committees, will apply our mind to in the report we write, the BRRR report. We have ourselves, as a scoff, I remember, raised this issue last year with the minister. We said, to what extent are the budgets of all departments, including your own, meaning National Treasury, consistent with the MTSF, and in other words, the NDP? How can we align all these departments' budgets and their programs and plans and activities and whatever with the MTSF, which is expression for this five-year term of the NDP? And we said we'll pursue that further, and we haven't. So that will be linking what we said last year to what we're going to say this year. I think you yourselves, your committee, also agreed on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Karim. Honourable members, I sensitise you to also read the IMF report of October 2016. It is available. Our researcher, Fundi, is sitting there at the back under the screen. She can just email that to the honourable members that you have a look at that as well. Honourable members, we are every year busy with the BRRR process. We take resolutions, two recommendations, observations, you name it. We'll have to go back to those resolutions we as a committee took in the NNENSOP. A tracking mechanism, what happened to that recommendation we did and we made. Secondly, or thirdly, the quarterly reports being produced by the PBO is a very important document, and I believe that we will have to engage formally on a quarterly basis with the National Treasury present. Yes, then we're doing our oversight role to pick up the trend. related to what happened the previous 3-4 years. So that's the way going forward for commodities. Manufacturing. How do you uplift? How do you get economic growth? You must manufacture. See what is happening in Mexico. A growth rate of 3%. Inflation 2.6. Yes. Yes. So we have to look at manufacturing, because if you manufacture, you must sell. You sell domestic, you sell abroad, you get revenue in. Revenue for the government. Yes. Professor Janie Rousseau last year in the public hearings referred to measurable deliverables. Yes. It stuck in my mind. We will have to focus on that. Select Committee for Finance, after all the deliberations, we stay behind just to adopt our committee report on the provincial treasuries. You received an email this morning. Prof, you may respond after the reply by Prof. Co-chairs, Honorable Mohai, the other co-chair will then do the wrapping up and closing remarks. Prof, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Chairs. Thank you, Honorable Members, for those questions. If I may start with the issue raised by Honorable Mania. I think it's a critical point about, I wasn't being facetious about the first economic thing, but I think it's a critical issue that, you know, you face even when you teach non-economic students, is how do you pitch it and at what level do you pitch it? And maybe I think, Chair, there's a need for a discussion with our four chairs as to, you know, the level of pitching the economics. I think you also related it, Chair, that maybe this is a bit too technical. So dumb it down a bit or bring it down a bit. I think Honorable Mania is saying push it up a bit. So I think we need a discussion around that, which I must admit we haven't done in this regard. So the level at which you pitch it, I think, is going to be important, how we pitch it, etc. We've had this debate, Honorable Mania, in the PBO as to, you know, how do you pitch it, what do you put in. I at one stage even said take out the grass, you know, make it easier, etc. So it's important that I think we have that discussion and debate as to, you know, at what level you're going to pitch it. And we experience this with MBA students as well. You know, there's some people who come in with medical degrees and they have no economics. And you have to teach at that level. And, you know, there's people with master's degrees. So at what level you pitch it becomes a critical thing. So I think that debate needs to happen. And maybe I'll take it up with my chairs to see how we, you know, bring it to that level. And maybe the next time around, Honorable Karim, your point as well, is, you know, how do we present it around next time with your approval.
No, this is misunderstood. No. One's not talking about dumbing it down. One's talking about being user-friendly, right? One's talking about actually making it accessible. At the same time, what I'm saying, dumb it up, if there's such a term. In other words, you can make... See, one should not confuse form and content. I mean, Mohammed, I mean, really, I'm surprised that we're having this discussion. It's not about form and content. The content has to be upped. Because I really think, you know what, there has to be a big leap between what you're doing and what we need. So the content has to be upped. But the form of presenting it has to be more user-friendly. That's the point. So we're not talking about bringing the standards down. The second thing is, the analogy with master's students, and Mohammed, with due respect to you, Professor, is not relevant here. We are politicians, right? And we are ultimately, this is not an intellectual seminar. The real test, comrades, is going to be, colleagues, is going to be what we write in our reports in the MTBPS, and more importantly, how we hold the executive to account and ourselves to account for decisions we take. We keep raising with the executive, why haven't you done such and such? As MPs, we never ask, why haven't we done what we said we would do based on our reports? So basically, let's not conflate things. We want a better quality and a more advanced input, but in a much more user-friendly way. So let's not conflate form and content, right? As I say this, I do not want to be linked to any other member who said anything in that regard. Please do not lump me with any other member. I really made a distinct and specific point with a very different agenda from anybody else who might have overlapped partly with what I said. In fact, it's not an overlap of content, maybe an overlap of some vague words, but let me be distinctly distant from anybody else who's spoken in regard to that. All I'm saying is simpler, clearer, more user-friendly, but the content needs to
point be
better.
Point of order, Chair. In terms of the rules, as far as I understand, you can be stopped for being repetitive. And I think Honourable Karim has now made his point and he's going on and on and on. Thank you.
I want to give it another heading. It was the Yunus Karim flavour. Finish on clock. That's it. The Yunus Karim flavour. Yeah. Prof, you and your team, please reply. You've got 33 minutes to do that.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm going to ask Brandon to address the issue that Honourable Mania raises about the credibility.
Thanks, Prof. So just touching on two points or two questions around the credibility of the revenue estimate. Firstly, Honourable Mania, on the methodology itself, we're fortunate enough to have pretty good relationships with the Office for Budget Responsibility in the UK, the Congressional Budget Office in the US, and the Parliamentary Budget Office in Canada. So this particular methodology is pretty standard practice. I've discussed with them in person before running this particular estimate. It's not as simple as saying that we just do a linear projection. What we do is we consider the monthly profiles of how revenue was collected in the previous year. So it considers how the provisional tax collections relating to corporate, and then your PIT is generally more linear. And what it does is it projects forward based on the 5 months of data that we had at the time of writing, but it considers or maintains the monthly profile of the previous fiscal year. And this particular methodology, as I say, was fairly standard. So it's the same sort of estimate that's produced in the US, the UK, and Canada.
Thank you for the opportunity. There's a few questions that related to work I've been doing in the PBO, so I'm going to respond in that respect. In the order that they were asked, one was regarding investor confidence. Yes, I mean, it's obvious in investor confidence, and which then informs investment, both short-term investment as well as fixed capital investment, is obviously a function of both domestic and international developments. We saw with the cabinet reshuffle towards the end of last year, significant depreciation of the rand and increase in South African bond yields, and a decoupling in SA growth and SA bond yields from other emerging market economies, which is pretty decent to suggest that local factors do have a real impact. However, over the years, since the beginning of the year, and if you look at the PBO's quarterly economic briefs from March, June, as well as September, we have noted this, and I think most all four committees over here are privy to those reports. So that's the first one. There is obviously an SA risk premium, which if you look at bond yields, and that indicates essentially investors noting that there is SA-specific risk, and it's not purely we're not purely lumped with other emerging market economies. The second question related to my work was the impact of growth and poverty. We've noted this in the previous quarterly economic brief that South Africa has been experiencing negative economic growth on a per capita basis over the past 4 years, and this certainly has an impact on overall standards of living and average income in the country. At the same time, the country is also, the narrow definition of unemployment is at a 10-year high, and broad unemployment is also quite high, and youth unemployment, as Prof mentioned, is close to 50%. So certainly there's an impact of growth on poverty. Honourable Fig, you asked a question regarding the 3% growth figure from the previous quarter. That's the quarter from April to April, May, June this year. It should be noted that that was a quarter-on-quarter growth rate. Now, that quarter-on-quarter growth rate comes off a particularly low base in the first half of the year. If you look at a year-on-year comparison, so that's the second quarter of this year compared to the second quarter of 2015, growth was a modest 0.6%. Now, it should be noted that prior to that growth figure coming out from Stats SA for the second quarter, many analysts, and not just market analysts, but also quasi-governmental analysts and research institutions such as the BER and the South African Reserve Bank, were much more tepid on South Africa's growth prospects for the current year. Some like Old Mutual, Nedbank were forecasting a contraction for this year. So the strong second quarter performance has actually reduced the probability of us experiencing a contraction this year, which is good news, but that good news needs to be contextualized, right? So momentum seems to have picked up. However, certain sectors, it may just be coming off a low base. So it is, the situation is a bit better now than it was 2 or 3 months ago, but it's still not great. Next question regarding the benchmark for debt. National Treasury have not committed the country to a debt benchmark. However, what does happen when it comes to debt levels, and international literature varies regarding the appropriate level of debt. Where we are as a country right now is our ratings is a big concern. So the ratings determines our appetite and our potential to take on more national debt. Compounding that is the level of contingent liabilities as well as provisions, which increase. So you add that to net debt, and it's well above 70%. And much of our next year provides that. So these are concerns. So the amount of debt you can raise is the amount of debt you can raise by maintaining a relatively low interest expenditure. Now, countries like Japan have debt well beyond 140, 150% as a percentage of GDP. Now, that's possible because it's Japan. So investors consider, through the ratings agencies, Japan a far safer bet. Consequently, yields on new Japanese debt is quite low compared to South Africa, where yields have been increasing over the past couple of years. So I think you need to put that into context. Now, having said that, though, particularly regarding the question on debt costs, what South Africa has done, and we've been pretty prudent in this respect, is the foreign currency denomination of South Africa's debt is a very small portion. So if you compare us to other emerging market economies that have been downgraded, like Brazil, like Turkey about a month ago, like Russia, we have a very favorable composition. So what Treasury has been doing is they've had a low foreign currency denomination. They've put in new benchmarks regarding short-term money, which is good from a liquidity perspective and a cost perspective, but it increases the uncertainty of your debt financing costs. So we've changed those profiles as well as a country. So when it comes to national government's debt, it's in a pretty healthy position. However, when it comes to when we include contingent liabilities and as well as provisions, the situation is far more constrained, which affects our ability to raise more debt for national government priorities. Those are questions related to my area of work. Thank you.
Thank you. Just in response to some of the comments by honourable members, and I apologise if we tried to put too much, especially in the beginning, in providing the global context and talking about unconventional macro policies, etc. And I think maybe hopefully in the future there'll be more room for us to explain this and the implications, and also to understand the long-term trajectories in policy changes. And I think that's really important because it raises issues about how we think about economics and what we think is first-year economics and what isn't. And the fact that a lot of people who have that kind of perspective have actually been totally wrong about the global economy and the fact that it was going into a crisis and looked at the wrong issues. The whole world, or the whole world of from the Fed and those kind of economists were looking over here when the train crash was happening over there. And that raises important issues, especially in the developing country where we have to deal with huge problems of unemployment, poverty, etc., of what the role of a PBO is. Do we actually do on a day-to-day basis what the Canadian PBO does, or do we actually consider the broader developmental implications and feed that into the oversight process? So, and within that, the question of, you know, what is useful statistics and what is those kind of things, I think those we do want more input from the members. We do want to know those kinds of things, and I think the four chairs can feed that into us, but we also need to know within the context of,
of how you want it and also why you want it, so that we can actually explain things within a broader framework, given the changes in the world and given the changes in conventional thinking about macroeconomic policy, the role of fiscal policy and monetary policy and those things. So I'm not saying this as a criticism, but as a way to positively move forward, so that we don't end up with accusations that I find actually quite the word escapes me, but it wasn't a nice criticism for me, but maybe that's because I'm new in Parliament and I'm not used to the state of the debate here.
Wait till you do door to door, then you will get it.
I do want to reiterate or just say that I agree with what my colleague Rashad Amra was saying about debt ceilings, and that in thinking about what debt ceilings should be and how sensitive we should be to voices in financial markets when making those kind of political decisions about what we think is a sustainable deficit, the global economic picture and where we've come from is important. And so I think in response to the Honourable Fick's question about that we keep looking at the past, I started off talking about past dependency. And I think it's really important that we understand a lot of our weaknesses and a lot of weakness in the global economy come out of that. The specific South African issues, one of the members mentioned self-inflicted harm, and we've seen that happening not only in South Africa, but in Brazil and other places. And there are also problems with things like investor confidence. But a lot of that, we're seeing patterns emerge within the global economy shaped by what's happening in countries, but also linked to global phenomena. And I think in this period when things are really difficult for everyone, we start to see more and more of that kind of conflict at a political level that is damaging to the domestic economy. And so basically when times are good, people still fight, but the fights, I think, are less damaging to the economy because the economy is able to tick over irrespective. And within that context as well, I think it may be worthwhile in the future to consider the long-term investment trends, fixed investment trends in South Africa, where it was coming from, which sectors, and I don't think we've got time to do that. We did do a presentation to the Appropriations Committee on industrial incentives and the effectiveness, and I think quite a bit of that information came out in that, but I think that's a broader discussion because there seems to be a lot of interest in linking the budget, the issues of debt ceilings, debt spiraling out of control, etc., to investment and addressing other developmental issues. Then just a question, I started out supporting what Rashad was saying about debt levels. And so I think given that, we should be careful not to talk about debt spiraling out of control, just because the different levels and the different countries are affected differently by that. And I think there's no empirical or support in the literature to think that South Africa's debt will soon be spiraling out of control, and that's something maybe we could talk about in the future as well. I think, yeah, the link to the point that I made earlier about sort of being clearer on the kind of at least statistical advice and numbers that you aren't given, I think we should link that to the Honourable Karim's comment about giving you guys more options, the Honourable Members more options in terms of thinking about that. And I think that's also something, given the complexity of linking day-to-day movements in revenue expenditure and debt levels to the overall development framework, so that we can understand how to develop the scenarios and the options as well. Thank you.
I will just respond to Honourable Lowe in terms of whether we did any further analysis on the budget in the Eastern Cape. We didn't. We just looked at the holistic picture and try and compare provinces with each other on a high level. And the other question was in terms of Honourable Karim, our work that we did on the NDP. We did two reports. The first one was on the progress and alignment of the MTSF with the NDP. The findings was most of them are aligned, but there were some technical issues and constraints for the implementation of the MTSF. The second report was about the alignment of the budget with the NDP and the MTSF outcomes. And we tried to determine whether it's possible for our committees to do oversight in terms of performance and expenditure. And the findings was that it's at this stage it's not possible. And we really went deep down to the root cause of why it's not possible. So I think we have shared those reports, and we've presented both of them to the Standing Appropriations Committees. But we can resend it, and if you need a conversation about it or more explanation, I'm really willing to do that. Because those reports really went to the root causes of why we can't do monitoring on those two documents. The other question, I think it was Honourable Isaac said that everything falls on deaf ears. You're right. Things fall on deaf ears. Departments don't implement guidelines. They don't adhere to those things. And I think we as the PBO can't even go there. But if there's a guideline that comes out from National Treasury, I'm the first one to get it on the website and read. And when you look at what departments do, they don't implement the guidelines. So it's very low down and very technical, but is it really for us to really monitor that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think our colleagues with that. Yeah. Chair, there's just a few. I think Honourable Lees raised the issue of expenditure ceiling together with Honourable Isaac. I think we've covered that on the bottom list, but I think the issue there is, it's like inflation targeting. You know, how far do you want to push it in or out? And it's up to us as a country to decide at what level, you know, the expenditure ceiling is going to be implemented or not. It is a way of curbing issues or, you know. So I hope that addresses it, but there are norms and guides, you know, internationally. Whether it applies to us is another story. So as a country, we need to look at how we discuss expenditure ceiling issues, Chair, you know, with Treasury or taking it forward. I think, Honourable Buthelezi, you raised some very critical issues. QE, I think Siraj touched on that briefly, and, you know, the outcomes of it. I think unconventional macroeconomic policies is basically saying, what do we have today, and maybe, you know, if it's not achieving growth, it's not achieving human development, maybe we should look at other macroeconomic policies, you know, and look at international best practice, evidence, and come and say, well, this is what other countries are doing. And we've done this in the past. We've said this is what China is up to, this is what the Asians are up to, and we've learned from them. So, for example, a lot of the policies that we've learned from other countries, Honourable de Blanche, maybe linking with your thing as well, about political risk, of course, influences, you know, and I know it's a big business in the rating agencies to just focus on political risk. So they look at these issues, you know, together with the macroeconomic consequences. I think Siraj also pointed out to you, honourable members, that there's a lot of countries that have been downgraded, you know, including Turkey, etc., yet doing a roaring trade in those kind of terms. So what do we learn from other countries? What are these other, and maybe not unconventional, but what are these other kind of macroeconomic developmental policies that we need to consider, you know, to put the country on a different growth trajectory or developmental trajectory in that sense? And I think the point is right that Honourable Buthelezi makes about not losing sight of poverty and inequality. It is at the heart of our issues. And I think we will build it in, Honourable Chair. as we go forward and as we have our discussions with our chairperson as to what to include. Honorable Fig, I think you've been addressed as well in your issue. Honorable Slangeni, I think you covered in that sense with Buffalo City and Honorable Isaac, I think you also make a critical point around value add, and I think Honorable Sheikh Imam did that as well, in terms of our economic growth, in terms of putting us on a new trajectory. And how do you add value to the economy? I mean, there's a debate, and I think, Siraj, we spoke about this, that South Africa is an old economy. You know, we still have agriculture, mining, whereas the new economies, you know, are more tech-savvy, more production-orientated or manufacturing-orientated. Trade relations are different, you know, in that sense. So, for example, Honorable Mania, in the old days, trade was, you know, I sell to you what you don't have, comparative advantage. Nowadays, Toyota makes cars not in Japan, but in South Africa, you know, and so trade relations have changed as well. We need to look at these issues and consider it as well. Honorable Chair, thank you, I think.
Thanks, thanks, Prof. Am I correct to say that was your concluding remarks? Okay. Thanks very much, Honorable Members. I think the objective of the meeting was quite clear, to allow the PBO to set the scene for the upcoming presentations of the Minister of the Medium-Term Budget Policy Statement next week on the 26th. So it will be exactly on the same day, I think, on Wednesday. And we'll be in a lock-up session to go through the documentation. So as indicated, that the PBO presentation was very helpful in many respects to present facts, research to members to strengthen our capacity to play a meaningful, robust oversight. So particularly regarding the reprioritization of national budget, it's important because this sets us in motion to discuss the budget. So points out on areas which requires further attention and which are priorities. So members already have made comments and contributions towards that direction, that points that there is a need for robust discussions regarding the current economic outlook. So we do agree with the comments made by members that PBO, how we engage with PBO as well as chairpersons, will be much more pointed in terms of areas which you want the PBO to be of assistance to the committees, particularly even regarding the possible policy options, presenting the state of affairs and the possible policy options. For instance, if you stated in a previous report that the illicit flows of capital harm our economy, we'll be interested into what options, what possible ways of dealing with this kind of trend, and which corporations and so forth and so forth, so that there is a much more richer discussion, so qualitative development from our previous discussion. So, members, I think it is quite clear that the current global outlook and also the devastating impact of the 2008 world economic crisis still harming very small economies like our South Africa, developing economies. So we really need to deal with those issues. What are the areas of vulnerabilities? And I believe that all of us are very keen to engage with what the minister will present next week in terms of what will be objectives, subjective factors, what is it that will be positioning ourselves as a country in terms of growth and development. So we'll be interested as a family of finance to deal with the linkage between the budget and the government priorities. I think that will dominate our attention as members of this Committee for Finance and Appropriation. And nothing else but discipline of action is all what we'll be focusing at. So thank you very much for your participation in this meeting. And you are adjourned.